Hello, everyone. I'm Mark Weinstein, and welcome back to another episode of the Cedarville Stories podcast. It's great to have you listening today, and I am confident you are going to be inspired and encouraged after my conversation today with Debbie Matheson. Debbie has been on the front lines in helping people in some of the most difficult situations for the past 26 years. In fact, I can't name a person in Greene County, Ohio, who has impacted more lives in a positive, Christ-like way than Debbie has during her tenure with the Violence Free Futures organization. She joined Violence Free Futures back in 1998 as a child and family counselor, just 1 year after earning her degree in social work from Cedarville University. She has held various positions with the organization and was given the responsibility of executive director in 2011, a position she still holds today. So let's go to my conversation with Debbie Matheson today on the Cedarville Stories podcast. Debbie, welcome. It's great to have you on the program. And I knew of you before, but it was recently when you spoke at the Beaver Creek Rotary Club that it dawned on me that I need to have you on the podcast because you were talking about important things going on at Violence Free Futures. And that's the main topic for today. But before we get there, you know, I did some research. I talked to people that you know, and I understand you have a passion for gardening.
I do.
So, I mean, what my one source said is it's a huge garden. How big is your garden and what do you grow during Ohio's short growing seasons?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so about half an acre.
Half an acre, that's big.
And yeah, I really enjoy some staple items like tomatoes and green beans. Usually every year I try to grow something unusual like artichokes. Sometimes I try other things like celery, and it's just amazing how growing things in your own space is a little bit different than the way they end up looking at the grocery.
I understand. How did the celery work out for you guys?
Yeah, so the celery was very green. Like you go to the store and it looks like a pale green.
It does.
But in the in the garden, it grows a very deep green color, much more like grass than the lime green color of celery at the grocery. And the artichokes were enormous, very decorative. The leaves had little sharp points on them, but you know, the bloom is really what you eat in an artichoke.
Okay.
So that was fun to grow.
So what's the plan for 2024? What's the unique item this year?
So I haven't quite picked it yet.
Okay.
So I've been looking, and it's about that time to start things. Like working on slips right now for sweet potatoes. So that's fun.
With a half an acre, that's a lot of garden. What do you do with all the food? I know you eat a lot of it, but you probably can't eat all, or do you can it?
Well, I love canning and freezing items. I might be chasing people around with things from the garden, but I grow a lot of vining plants.
Okay.
So very unique pumpkins, not just your orange pumpkin, but some kind of like Cinderella pumpkins and Morty pumpkins and like to do that.
So how did you get interested in gardening? And then what's your secret to success?
I grew up in a home where gardening was a really important part of how we ate. And so I enjoyed that process. I learned to love it. My older brother said not so much.
Okay.
He does not grow things. My younger brother also enjoys growing things. So my mom got about two-thirds of us excited about it and one-third of us not.
Yeah. But you definitely have it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So another bit of news that I learned, and I don't believe it's breaking news, you are planning to retire from work.
Oh, yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
So as someone who thought about retirement more now than I did 30 years ago, I mean, I'm definitely closer to retirement age. How did you determine now was a time to retire from what you've been doing for your professional life?
Well, as I really try to prioritize my own family, and my husband has just retired, we felt like this would be a good time and space for us to make some transitions in our lives, do a little bit of refocusing. And so in that process, I've set a little bit of a goal, really looking at completing an outreach program, building rehab at work, and then being in a space to continue to support the work, but from a backseat.
What other plans do you have in mind for your retirement years?
Oh, yeah.
You're smiling like you can't wait.
Oh, we have some travel plans. So we'll be heading to Scotland this summer for the Highland Games. My husband is Scottish, and so the Matheson clan is a featured clan at one of the Highland Games this summer in Scotland. And so we'll be there doing that. And just going to make a little bit of an adventure and make a few other stops in Europe. And then we're going to just be in a space where we are ready to be used in whatever direction God wants us to go, but really to have an opportunity to do that as a family unit.
As I mentioned in the introduction, Debbie is highly respected in Greene County for mm-hmm. her work with Violence Free Futures. To help our listeners understand what violence-free futures mean, because that's a term that maybe our listeners don't know, can you share with us the mission of this organization and the kind of work that your team does on a daily basis?
Yes. So we are a dual domestic and sexual violence service provider, and our mission is really to be in the community and interrupt the cycles of domestic or sexual violence within familial relationships or within other acquaintance type relationships. And so as we get in there and interrupt that, we try to do that through some very specific ways, working in the middle schools and high schools and really trying to impact youth and help them think about what are healthy relationships. Sure. We work with the juvenile court. We work with all the law enforcement jurisdictions, following up on domestic disputes, cases of violence, protection order violations, really trying to reach into the homes of the survivors and help them have a voice and an ear to listen to them. We also run a safe housing program, a 24-hour hotline. That's the access point to get into safe housing. So we are staffed 24/7 in that process of making sure that if somebody's in an abusive relationship, there is someone on the other end of the line that can help them. We have a text line, so folks are also able to reach us that way, which is a very quiet way from your home to communicate if you don't feel like you could have a phone conversation. Yeah.
So when you think back to your years with Violence Free Futures, you have to have some level, I assume, of satisfaction because you've had to impact so many people. Do you recall a story or two, maybe one, where you really had an impact and you see it even to this day?
This is an experience from early on in my time with our program. I was the child and family counselor at that point, and I was really trying to work hard with a young mom. She had been a university student from our community. There are five universities in our county. We're very rich in that way. But she had a little guy, and they were really struggling to have a good relationship. There's a lot of abuse that had been in the home. And I was encouraging her to think about playing with your son. Oh, that's so ridiculous, Debbie. I don't want to play with my kid. Like, I'm an adult.
Yeah.
We need to play too. So she went to a counseling session and I was interacting with her son. When she came back into the shelter from that counseling appointment, he and I were riding pretend horses. He had a stick horse.
Okay.
We can all think of these from our childhood.
Sure,
stick horse with that horse head on the top. And I just had an imaginary one. And so I said, this would be a good time to play. And then I just neighed off into my office, and her son handed her the stick horse. And then I just went in my office and shut the door, and I listened and listened. And they romped in the living room for about 15 minutes, and there was laughter, and there was just some good connection.
Mm-hmm.
In the morning when I came in the next day, on my desk was a little Pepsi Cola keychain, and it said my name and her name on it. And I knew that she was saying thank you.
Yeah.
And that made a difference in my life. You know, that was kind of her message. I got what you were saying. This is what I have to give you. And so we celebrate often at work the things that aren't, you know, monumental that you're going to put on your wall, like a graduation, you know, certificate or anything,
right.
But that was such an important part of her process of healing.
Yeah, yeah, you made a big difference in her life, it sounds like, and obviously impacted you as well.
Yeah.
So when I think of social work, and I think of the professors that we have here at Cedarville and they're working in those areas. I know it takes a special kind of person to be a social worker. So how did the Lord guide you into the work of social work? Because that's challenging.
Yeah. Well, in my family growing up, we never shied away from hard work. And we always kind of as a family prioritized the process of helping individuals that were hurting, supporting them. As I thought about what is it that I wanted to do, I knew I wanted to help. And so I sat quietly with a Cedarville catalog and I flipped through the majors and just said, what is in here that seems to match the talents and skills I've been given?
Yeah.
And in the end of my venture could really lead me in a place where I was supporting others. And so I landed on social work and I spent some time reading through that. And I said, I really think that this is it. And so I spent time my senior year that fall just kind of kicking it around, praying about it. And as I moved towards graduation, I had a much firmer belief that that was really the direction that was going to be good for me. And I have never looked back.
Social workers see a lot of the ugly parts of life. And there's no way to get around it. I've had Melissa Brown on the podcast. I've talked to George Huff, who's one of my favorites here at Cedarville, about social work. I've asked him these questions, so I'm interested in your perspective. How do you personally work yourself through the things that you see? Because just because you're helping someone doesn't mean you don't take it home with you. So how are you able to separate that and keep yourself healthy?
That's a very good question, and I'm going to lean on a tool that I learned while I was here at Cedarville. Okay. During our internship process, we had journals that we had to write for our time that we would spend at our internships. And in that process, I learned to be self-reflective about the time I had spent helping others, to look at the way I interacted. Is there something I would like to do better or different the next time? Was there something that was just burning inside of me that said, Debbie, that wasn't the most honoring thing that you could have done to one of God's children? And so upon graduation and then landing a job at Violence Free Futures, I asked the question you're asking me, how am I going to do this?
Yeah.
And I grabbed a spiral notebook. Every day when I came home, I just started writing. And I wrote for 2 years until one day I said, oh, what I think I have just understood is that I cannot work harder than what anyone else is going to do to work in their own life. And it allowed me to create a separation between the impact of what was happening in that person's life and my ability to lay out a smorgasbord of choices for them.
Yeah. Right.
And not have to feel like it was my responsibility. I couldn't put them on my shoulders. Didn't mean I didn't lean in.
Right.
And think about things like motivational interviewing and how I could try to encourage someone to think about a better life for themselves, to think about dreaming again when they thought all their dreams had been dried up like a raisin in the sun. But I knew it wasn't my responsibility to carry it. And also, I love to pray and I can pray at work all day long and nobody has any idea that I'm doing it. And sometimes my prayers are very simple, just help, you know, bring something to mind to encourage this person. And also on my office door is seek justice, love mercy, walk humbly.
Micah 6:8.
Yes. And that has been a sustaining message for me.
Why should someone who's looking at social work, maybe they're a high school junior or senior, look at Cedarville? Because it seems like our professors in our program seem to know what it takes to produce God-honoring social workers. Is that a fair assessment?
Absolutely. And social work came out of the church.
It did.
And I think what a better way to really be honoring the idea of the profession than to go to a university that understands the fundamental components of the value system of where the birth of social work really was. And the university is uniquely poised in its position in the state also as a significant leader in being a producer of effective social work students. I navigate the difficult conversations, navigate what is happening culturally in the world, but from that biblical world and life view.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned just a few minutes ago that Cedarville is poised. How can you articulate that? How are we poised to be that in the state of Ohio?
And as I came to a field instructor training just this fall, listening to Professor Huff talk about the ranking of bachelor's level social work programs, and Cedarville is number two in the state. And that's a very specific measure of how we are poised. You know, that is beating out many public universities. When the Council on Social Work Education comes to talk to the students here, they get excellent answers.
Yeah. I have to believe that our position and why we were number two in the state of Ohio really has to boil down to our distinctive belief in Christ.
Absolutely.
That's the key factor.
Absolutely.
With your vast experience in social work, this has given you a lot of opportunities to be a valuable resource, not just with people, but actually as an expert witness during some court hearings.
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean to be an expert witness in the social work area for the courts?
Yeah, so very specifically, when the judicial process is happening and there's going to be a jury of someone's peers that will be making a decision, the courts look to say, who is someone that could come and provide some clear and decisive and expert direction around topics. So for both domestic and sexual violence, I have served as an expert witness, being able to talk about the dynamics that exist in domestic violence and sexual violence relationships.
So it's not necessarily case specific, but it's an overarching umbrella.
Correct.
How has your work as an expert witness impact cases?
Yeah, so I think very specifically looking at bringing information to a jury about what are the typical behaviors that a victim is going to have. By the time a victim makes it to court, they have shared their story multiple times with law enforcement, multiple times with the prosecutor. And so they're not going to be in a moment of just sharing it for the first time, though someone in a jury is going to be hearing it for the first time. So someone who is experiencing that process of having to be on the hot seat and share what they experienced as a victim, they may not cry. They may look really flat. But one of my roles is to just share information around how trauma impacts an individual, thinking about fight, flight, freeze, and fawning, because those are typical trauma responses to horrible experiences that individuals are having.
From when you started 26 years ago to this day, how has the profession changed? Or maybe it hasn't, maybe it's still the same, but what's your perspective on that?
I would say definitely I've seen in that window a significant amount of change. Some of the change that I see is we'll have women that are coming into the shelter and having a different level of access to their children. Most of the time in the early part of my profession, women coming into the shelter had the custody of their children. And now we see a reduced number of women coming into the shelter with custody, but we see a growing complexity in some of the situations that are in their lives. For example, domestic violence survivors are 14 times more likely than anyone else in society to reach for a substance to deal with the chaos that's gone on in their home. And so then there is a process of somebody trying to recover from the trauma of abuse, and also having to try to navigate this addiction now that's in place in their lives.
Why has the percentage gone down for women moms with child custody?
I think some of it is that complex nature of what we see having happened within those relationships, where there is maybe another layer of substance use that's a part. So maybe both partners have substance abuse issues and children are placed with family at a distance. You know, so it's a lot of that that is really significant. And on average, a domestic violence survivor is going to leave an abusive relationship 7 times and it will span 8 years.
Really?
So that's a long period of time for people to be trying to navigate, you know, all the dynamics in a relationship.
Yeah. Why is it so hard to get out of a domestic violence situation? Because if they go back 7 times, is it fear or what's causing them to come back?
That's a good question. And I'm glad you said the word fear, because fear definitely is a significant part of what draws someone back. It can be fear of what's going to happen in my life. I have no idea. I don't know what that other individual is doing. And so I need to be a little closer and tuned in, because I don't know if, you know, we're seeing, you know, if I'm going to be experiencing, say, a higher level of violence.
Right.
If I'm not seeing that person day in and day out, I'm not able to take a pulse on what's happening to them and where their brain is, what they're thinking about. But there's the whole process of people don't get into an intimate relationship because they want to just like leave at the first sign of trouble. So many people are looking for chances and they want to believe promises that are being made. And we believe that people can change. We 100% believe that. But there's got to be accountability with that process and not just, I promise I'm going to not hit you again, or I promise I'm not going to force you to do a sexual activity you don't want to, or I promise that I'm going to go to counseling. Well, promise me and then let me see you do that for 6 weeks. And then we can have a different conversation. I want to see that there's difference, not just hear an empty promise.
Yeah. Given the sensitivity and directness of being a social work professional, how can a Christian effectively work in social work and really have a long-term career in that very difficult role?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say always having good mentors.
Who was your good mentors?
Well, so you've mentioned Professor Huff. So he's on my speed dial. If I am dealing with a difficult situation, he's someone that I process that with.
Okay.
So, you know, that piece is very important. And many of our conversations start with prayer, end with prayer. And so I want to maybe give credence first to the fact that having a really strong and foundational relationship with Jesus and understanding the redemptive power there, it's just the grounds for what needs to be in place when we look at that social work component and being able to see that people need forgiveness, being able to offer that. But with accountability, again, we don't see that our walk in faith is just Jesus died and you can say, you know, basically, oh, hey, save me, and then not have our life change. You know, we're really looking for the fruit of the Spirit to be present.
Transformation.
We want to see that transformation in someone's life. And so a Christian social worker is very uniquely poised to share a cup of cold water in Jesus' name without even having to say that. That I've had an opportunity to serve have just said, you're different. You're different. One particular person said, you're different. I think you go to church. What church do you go to?
Oh, wow.
Shared the name. She said, once I went there, just having that moment.
Yeah.
And also honoring in the social work world, as we look at many people, we have to honor that every person is a spirit being.
Absolutely.
And so we can't ignore the God-sized whole that is in the heart of humans and how we can be able to point them to a time in their own life when maybe faith was very important and point them back.
I know there are good social workers who are unbelievers.
Yes.
How can they be as good as they should be without that faith in Jesus?
I would say that I'm going to evoke maybe Dr. Jordan Peterson for just a second, you know, in his venture as a professional helper and navigating through a time of coming to a place where he still grapples with faith and his relationship with God and Jesus, but he's landed in a place where he's found that to be essential. But he has many great technical skills in how to interview and how to ask people open-ended questions so that they can be self-reflective in their life. So there are skills and talents that are really essential to the social work profession and the professional helping world.
Yeah.
But there is an important piece, I think, that misses or can be missed with not being a believer, because I believe I have unconditional positive regard for all.
You treat all people the same and with kindness and as Christ would, and Christ has done for us. So my final question as we wrap up the podcast is, you've been at Violence-Free Futures for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure it's going to be maybe a little hard to leave, but you're excited as well. Mm-hmm. What's the future for this ministry in Xenia and in the Greene County, Ohio?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we do have something very exciting happening. We are opening an outreach center. It's on Progress Drive, and that is going to be a space where lots of counseling work, advocacy work, and support groups are going to be running directly from that building, and kind of having that space be separate and away from our housing campus.
Okay.
So where we currently operate right now, we're operating all our outreach services with our safe housing and our shelter space. So we're going to be separating those two.
Mm-hmm.
So that is going to be a next exciting phase for the agency, and definitely a space where I kind of see it as a bit of legacy that I'm leaving behind.
Yeah,
I actually started at the center under the agency's first name. We were the Greene County Domestic Violence Project.
Right.
Then we became the Family Violence Prevention Center. And I have shared with our board, let's be committed to not change our name anymore. But
right.
As Violence Free Futures, we really decided that we wanted to utilize what had been our vision statement for many years as our name, that we would all be working for Violence-Free Futures.
Yeah.
And so we see that kind of as very important. And just a quick note, so I started as a freshman at Cedarville University, mm-hmm. volunteering at the organization. So that was 1993. and so throughout all the years that I was here as a student, I had the opportunity to continue to volunteer. I did one of my internships also at the organization.
Okay.
I count all those years.
Absolutely.
So how many years total? So I will be rounding out at 30, a little bit over 30 years.
30, and you could volunteer as a high school student because you're a Cedarville girl, right?
Well, so I volunteered as a freshman social work student here from Cedarville at that university,
Yeah, but you were you're a village of Cedarville person.
Yep, I'm also a townie sometimes.
that's
how we reference ourselves.
Yeah, you do. So when does this new facility open?
So we've been meeting regularly on Thursdays, trying to make sure we're staying on the timeline. So we believe that we'll be opening about mid-June.
Okay. And when you spoke at Rotary, you talked about fundraising.
Yeah.
Is that what you're fundraising for, this facility?
So we've done some fundraising for that, but very generously, the Greene County Commissioners awarded our organization $1.1 million to establish the outreach center. I love their support because they know the work is so essential and impacts across the entire county.
Well, Debbie, our time is up, but I want to thank you for coming into the studio today and talking, sharing your life, sharing your story. You really have made a difference in Greene County. Thanks for that, and thanks for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you, Mark.
I want to thank you for listening to the Cedarville Stories podcast, brought to you by Cedarville University. You are encouraged to share, like, and review this podcast on your favorite podcast provider. And be sure to come back next week when we'll hear another Cedarville story for God's glory.